As we come to Daniel chapter 5, we continue in the first half of Daniel. We have more of a personal side of things in regards to Daniel and what's going on. Yes, we have some prophetic, but we're seeing more on the personal side, events in the lives of Daniel and his three friends and these kinds of things. And kind of everyday events. Not that outline. Nope. And we continue that through chapter 6. And once okay, why are you sorry about that. It's telling me I have a newer copy online. It's like, no, I already did that. Okay. So as we look at this, we move through chapter 6 with these events in the lives of various people, whether it's Daniel or whether it's his three friends, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, whether it's Nebuchadnezzar, even in the prophetic in chapter 2, it's, focusing on Nebuchadnezzar, something that happened in his life, kind of events, and that's what we've been looking at, and we still do that. We'll do that here in chapter 5, and then again in chapter 6 with Daniel in the lion's den. And then once we get into chapter 7 in the second half of the book, that's when we really start looking at in Daniel's day, prophecy. We still call it prophecy, but when we stop to think about it, a lot of the stuff's already taken place for us. The Medo-Persian Empire is not future for us. The Grecian Empire is not future for us. The Roman Empire is not future for us, at least a portion of it, the reviving of it. Yes, that's still future, but a lot of it has already, come to pass, which helps bolster us to realize as we look at prophecy in our day, by going back and realizing that these were prophetic events that happened literally, then that gives us credence to understand the events that have not happened yet, will they be done literally or figuratively? Literally. That's how it was understood. Again, that's how we understand the scriptures, is typically in a literal, historical, grammatical use, our interpretation, our hermeneutics, which we've looked at in the past. But, there are those that say, no, it needs to be allegorized. It needs to be spiritualized. We need to change it because it's prophecy. It's still prophecy for us, but when we see these events that were prophetic when Daniel wrote them, or Isaiah, or Jeremiah, or the minor prophets, whoever it is that we're looking at, and see that these are prophetic events, and we see that things tied to them that have happened were literally fulfilled, then there's no reason to believe that the rest of it won't be literally fulfilled. Because the other was. There would be no reason to think otherwise, especially when the author doesn't tell us that, oh, by the way, this part's being literally fulfilled, but I'm not going to literally fulfill this part. I'm going to spiritualize this. And God doesn't do that for us. And so it's helpful to me to see that and realize, well, no. He did all this prophecy back here. Look at the prophecies concerning Christ's first coming. All of it's literally fulfilled. And there's talk of his second coming that at times, they're kind of connected. And we don't understand, or they didn't understand that there was a break. There's like two mountain peaks. And they see the two peaks, but they don't see what's in between from that prophetic view back there. But now that time has gone forward, we do see that there's a valley. There's a gap, if you will, in time that's not recorded for us in the Old Testament. And we see Christ as he's, I believe, in the synagogue of Nazareth. And he quotes from Isaiah 61. And he stops mid-Hebrew sentence and tells them, this has been fulfilled in your day. And I'm paraphrasing what Christ said. He didn't continue because it talks about his second coming. Well, that hasn't been fulfilled yet. And Christ specifically stopped at that point. Why? Because that part had been fulfilled, to talk about his coming as Messiah. So we see these things and we should take it as that. There are those that are out there that are popular that say, no, you know, it needs to be allegorized. These things have already happened and other things. And it's like, no, there's so much that was literally fulfilled. We are to expect then the rest of it to be literally fulfilled. But as we come to our passage here in chapter 5, we see the villainy of King Belshazzar. And so let's get into this. This is the vision that he has, the handwriting on the wall, that phrase that we still use to this day. The handwriting's on the wall, meaning your day has come. You've done enough damage, and now you're getting, as some have used, you would say in the old days, your comeuppance. It's time for you to get your just desserts. And so where did that come from? Right here, the handwriting on the wall. But as we come into this, see, we see the wickedness of the king in verses 1 through 4. It says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And so we see the wickedness here with this king Belshazzar taking these holy vessels, these vessels that were set apart, used within the temple of Jerusalem, that we see taken away, and they were carted off to Babylon, put into storage, basically, because they were, again, they were gold and silver vessels. They are valuable items in a monetary sense, but they were sacred vessels. These were used in God's service. So they're holy vessels. They're set apart vessels for God and his worship in Jerusalem. And Belshazzar doesn't care. And so I want to look a little bit first at Belshazzar to note some things, because there are those that have brought up, well, Belshazzar wasn't king. And Nebuchadnezzar wasn't his father. And these things are easily looked at when we do find things, but discoveries as far back as 1861 have shown that Belshazzar was indeed king of Babylon. He was a co-regent with his father Nabonidus, who was away from the city for most of the last 10 years of his reign. Because of this, he made his son king in his absence. So Nabonidus had two interests going on. One was his interest in pagan gods, and he worked at restoring ancient temples to the sun god and the moon god, which we'll look at in a little bit and come back to that idea. So just kind of put that back in your mind. He seems also interested in either strengthening alliances or to control the trade routes. And so he also established his capital in Tema, which was halfway between Egypt and Babylon and between Damascus and Mecca. And so he's away from the city of Babylon, and has made his son, Belshazzar, king while he's out doing things in the rest of the empire as king. This also aligns with why Belshazzar would give the third ruler in the kingdom to whomever would interpret the writing on the wall, as we'll see in a moment. Because he notes, whoever can do this, I'll make you third ruler in the kingdom. Well, why would that be? Because Dad is the ultimate ruler. He's number one. I'm number two, which would make anybody else I give number three. And so it just, there's nothing wrong there. There's nothing hard to understand when we view these things that have been shown to us in the extra-biblical things that have been discovered through the years. And so we note that, as we've already touched on a little bit with the magnificence of the city, it was pretty much considered an impenetrable city. Kind of like the Titanic, you know, it's unsinkable. Babylon, it's a fortress, it'll never fall. Nobody can conquer this city. They had stores for 20 years. We can just close everything off and eat off the fat of the land inside for 20 years. We've got that much set aside for us. But as we will see by the end of the chapter, was that the case? No, Babylon falls before this evening is over that we have recorded for us. And we see this contempt for God. He has a complete disregard for the God of Israel. And we'll see that this is not something that is foreign to him. The God of Israel is not a foreign God to Belshazzar. As we've already seen, Nebuchadnezzar came face to face, if you will, confronted with the God of Israel as being the one true God. And that's going to bear out as we continue on here. But we see the writing on the wall, verses 5 through 9. It says, in the same hour came both fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. You know, his knees were knocking. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. And this is most likely the queen mother, or queen grandmother, in reference here, and we'll see that here in just a moment. There is a man in thy kingdom, verse 11, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams, and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts, were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. We kind of move on a little bit here with the section. But noting this, as this writing is on the wall, of course, I think we would all be troubled if we see a hand just appear and start writing on a wall. I'm sure our knees would start shaking too, and our countenance would change. We would probably be a little ashen white. Yeah, there you go. And so, yeah, these things get your attention. It certainly got Belshazzar's, as he's frightened to the core. This goes all the way inside. And the wise men come to read the interpretation on the wall, and nobody is able to read or interpret the writing. They could not read the writing may mean that they could not read the writing with understanding, because this wasn't a crazy language. This wasn't some foreign language that Daniel was able to understand because God gave him the understanding of that foreign language. It was just, it didn't, I think, as noted here, they could read it, but not with understanding. It was like, and I'll show that here in a minute as we look at the words. And we're also reminded with that, here we go. The words were literally number, number, weight, divided. Can we read that with understanding? I mean, now, we know the rest of the book, but, you know, if you were to see number, number, weight, divided, huh? Now, we haven't gotten to the words yet, the mene, mene, tekel, upharsin, that's later, but that's what those words mean, literally. If we were to see the handwriting on the wall in English, it would say number, number, weight, weight, meaning a weight, not wait as in stop and hold on for a moment, but weight and divided. Yeah, W-E-I-G-H-T. We would read it, but we wouldn't read it with understanding, would we? Because it kind of, it doesn't make sense. So yeah, I can't read it because my mind can't, it's not processing. What is this? And so we are reminded as we look at this ultimately is, on a kind of a side note, we are reminded the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God. Now this isn't something spiritual, but I think it alludes to it, if you will. Because who's writing this? God is. And God has words to say to Belshazzar, and he's put them on the wall. And we see the wisdom of the queen, and again, probably the queen grandmother, Nebuchadnezzar's wife, because she notes Daniel to us. Belshazzar, you have a man in your kingdom which seems to be that Daniel is not over these men at this point, because he didn't come in with them. The wise men, the magicians, the sorcerers, all these people whom he had been appointed over by Nebuchadnezzar. But now some years have gone by because Nebuchadnezzar is off the scene. Nabonidus, his son, is taken over. Nabonidus is out in the empire, and now his son Belshazzar is king, and somewhere along the way, Daniel has been removed from that position and is called in because of the queen grandmother saying, hey, there's a guy in your kingdom that can answer this for you. And she gives his resume, which Belshazzar, I'm sure, would have been familiar with. As we'll see, he is familiar with Daniel. But so he calls for them, and because who he was and what he could do and what she saw he could do in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And so there is wisdom here by her that, hey, these guys can't, but there is a guy in your community that can. And so somehow he may have been demoted for some reason, most likely because he was a Jew, and not a Chaldean, not a Babylonian, again, an outsider. And so let's continue. Then was Daniel brought in, verse 13. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of jewelry? I have even heard of thee that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck, and thou shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, it is interesting to note, Belshazzar calls him by his Jewish name, Daniel. He doesn't call him Belteshazzar. That's how Nebuchadnezzar referred to him, because he gave him that name. But we see that Belshazzar does not. And again, it could be because of the demotion. Number two, he's a Jew. Number three, do their names sound kind of similar? Yeah. Belshazzar means Bel protect the king. Belteshazzar means Bel protect his life. So there's a similarity there. And it could be between those things that he didn't want to refer to him in that regard because of that similarity of the meaning of their names. I'm not going to call you Belteshazzar because I'm Belshazzar. And don't want you to have anything to do with me. And so we see that, but probably going more back to the fact that he's of Jewry. He's of the tribe of, he's of the kingdom of the Jews, of Judah. He's been demoted. And so there is that distinction there, which is brought up. And so I think that's the primary reason why he calls him Daniel. You know, we don't care for you Jews. You are Jewish, and you're not one of us. And so I'm going to call you Daniel. I'm going to use your Jewish name, not the name given to you within my previous, you know, king's noting of you. And so Daniel will recount then Nebuchadnezzar's interaction as we come to verses 17 through 28. It says, then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would set up, and whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. For he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beast, and the his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth it over it whomsoever he will. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hath not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. But thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and have brought the vessels of his house before thee, that thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and of stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances, and art found wanting or lacking. You've come up short. Peres, which is the singular version of upharsin, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And so we have very quickly, as we pause here, Nebuchadnezzar recounts what we've just went through last Wednesday, particularly with the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar, of him being brought face to face with who God is and what he is able to do in the affairs of men. And he reiterates this to Belshazzar. It is the Most High God who gave Nebuchadnezzar the kingship. And so he recounts this in those short three verses, 19 through 21. But we see the pride of Belshazzar. And again, he refers to him as a son. It's a grandson. But as we see in the use of scriptures, are they specific with their designations? The son of David. We see lots of Judah's kings called the son of David. Were they literally his son? No, they could be his grandson, his great-grandson, his great-great-great-great-great-grandson, son of Abraham. I mean, we use the term specifically. If you're a son and daughter, we usually are referring specifically. A literal son or a literal daughter. We don't typically call our grandchildren our sons and daughters. They're our grandkids. We are much more specific with our terms of family than they were back then. And again, we see that usage throughout particularly the Old Testament. Again, we see son of David being used for lots of people that were not literally the son of David. And so it should not come as any surprise that we would see it here, that he calls him, you know, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. He is, in a loose sense, he's the grandson. And so we have that there. And again, people like to get particular. And it's like, really, there's no need to. It's not particular. But we see this happening. And Belshazzar knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel brings that to light. You knew what happened to your grandfather. And this is what you're doing. You're disregarding the Most High God, the God whom Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather, recognized as being the one true God. You know of those events. You know what took place. And in essence, you've turned your back on that God. You have followed false gods, yes, but now you're doing even more damage, if you will, to that relationship that you are to have with him, by making his sacred vessels set apart, sanctified vessels, and using them for common use. Pride filled his heart and lifted him up in opposition to the Lord in all of these things. And God doesn't take that lightly. We need to be careful. I mean, we don't have holy vessels to take lightly with. But I want us to consider the thought here of Belshazzar is brought into confrontation with what happened in somebody else's life that was good. Because again, I believe Nebuchadnezzar came to know the Lord, the one true God. And here this man has seen that event and has completely disregarded it. That nope, no impact on me, no bearing on my life. We do have that. As we see God work and move in other people's lives because of things that have taken place in their life, whether for good or for bad, I mean, we can use this illustration either way, may we be careful not to go down that same path and think that somehow we're going to have a different outcome. Because we're not. Our events may be different. God may take us home before he confronts us. But may we not be so foolish as to think, well, that worked for him, and that's okay, but, you know, I'll go down that same path, but I know I'm going to have a different outcome. No. God's promises are the same regardless of who's the one interfering with them, who's breaking them, who's following them or disregarding them. Again, looking at the good and the bad in this regard. And so as we see God at work in other people's lives, may we learn from it for ourselves. God blessed them. Why did God bless them? Well, they were obeying God. They were living for God. And look at how God has worked in their lives. Can God do that for me? Yes. As we live in obedience to Him, as we walk in the light of His Word, He will bless us. Maybe not to the same degree, maybe not in the same way, but He will bless us. Why? Because He's promised to. Well, that person went against God and His Word, and that's the result. Oh, that won't happen to me. Well, that event may not happen, but God will address the issue with us at some point, either in this life, or He may take us home and encounter it there. So may we take from that and realize we are accountable to our God, and we can learn or not learn from those around us. May we learn from them, the good and the bad, and take that away and say, God, I can live for You, and I need to be careful that I do live for You, because I've seen people that don't, and this is the outcome, and that's not pleasant. And so, Lord, I do need to live for You. Help me. And so may we take that from that. We see in amongst all of this, and we must remember, I didn't mention at the beginning, the Medo-Persian Empire is outside the walls of Babylon. They've been there for quite some time. Belshazzar is living on the knowledge, we've got stores for 20 years. We're fine. My father is out there. He'll come and save us. We're okay. That's why I can hold this feast. Because everything's just fine. Everything's not fine. And God has moved in the affairs of men. And yes, the Medo-Persian Empire has been taking over the Babylonian Empire. Slowly, piece by piece. And here they are sieging this capital city that is supposedly impenetrable, but they have a way around it. And we'll see that in a minute. But we see the judgment of God upon them as He notes, you've been weighed in the balances and found lacking. Your kingdom is departing from you, Belshazzar. And yet he doesn't believe it. Because if his kingdom is being taken from him, what good does it do to give Daniel to be the third in the kingdom? It means nothing. And so we'll finish it off. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Babylonians, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. We see the ruin of the king. Babylon fell to the Medo-Persian Empire without a fight. Yes, the soldiers have been outside the city, encamped around it, besieging it. Everybody inside thinking everything's okay because Nabonidus is out there. He'll save us. We've got plenty of stuff inside. We're sitting fat, dumb, and happy. No problems. But in the meantime, the Medes and the Persians have been diverting the Euphrates River, which runs through Babylon, and putting it into a lake so that the river disappears. Now, if you have a river going underneath a wall that's now gone, do you have access to the other side of the wall? Yes, you do. And yes, they did. They didn't have to beat down the walls. They didn't have to beat down the gates. They just diverted the river and then came in underneath the wall. So much for it being an impenetrable city. The other part to all of this is the people of Babylon itself were happy to have Darius the Mede come and take over. The Babylonians particularly liked Marduk, their god. But Nabonidus, as we noted, had been working on temples to the sun god and the moon god, not the Babylonian god. And so they were a little put out with their current rulers because their current rulers weren't as devoted to Marduk as they were. And here Darius has come and he is devoted to Marduk. Okay, yeah, thanks for coming. We'll follow you. Appreciate you coming in. You're a follower of Marduk like we are. Good. We didn't care for Belshazzar and Nabonidus much anyway because they weren't for our God. And so they take the city without a battle. And they're welcomed into the city by the inhabitants. Historians Xenophon and Herodotus describe the capture. And somehow they give a date of October 12th, 539 B.C. But biblically, prophetically, we find that its fulfillment, this falling of Babylon, is fulfilled of prophecy that Isaiah did in Isaiah chapter 21, verses 1 through 10, and Jeremiah prophesied about in chapters 50 and 51. So both of these prophets, Jeremiah closer to this time, because of course Jeremiah is during the time of the captivity. So he's closer in time when he's telling them the Babylonians are going to take you into captivity, but he's also letting them know the Babylonians are going to fall because of their haughtiness. God's using them, yes, to judge the Israelites, but God's going to judge them for how they dealt with the Israelites. And he's prophesying they're going to fall. Isaiah does it further back and notes the Babylonians at a time when the Babylonians weren't even an empire, and notes that they're going to rise up, but they're going to fall too. And so we see these prophetic events from these other prophets being fulfilled in Daniel's day with the fall of Babylon. With the taking of this city, the Babylonian Empire ceases to exist. We now go from the head of gold to the shoulders, the torso, the upper body, if you will, of silver, the Medo-Persian Empire, because it has taken over. And what was the Babylonian Empire is now the Medo-Persian Empire, as they have come in and taken over all that Babylon had, and it's now them. And so we move down our image that we see back in Daniel chapter 2, we leave the Babylonian Empire, it's now history, and we move into the Medo-Persian Empire, where we're going to spend most of the rest of our time, if you will, in the book of Daniel. As we get into chapter 7 and following, we're going to look at some of that and the Grecian Empire too as well, but we'll see some of these things and these interesting things about them and this alliance between these two, and we'll get into that in the coming weeks. But we'll get into chapter 6, Lord willing, next Wednesday.